Welcome to Tee Talk, where athletes share their stories. Join us as we explore the profound connections between sports, community, and the human experience.
We're here today with Mr. Bernard Robinson, All-American, Tulane football, NFL pro, Super Bowl championship winner, all of those things and a whole lot more, even a better person. So, Bernard, again, welcome to Tee Talk. Glad you decided to come and have a little talk with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. Having seen the previous episodes, I feel like I'm in some good company. I don't know how I got up this high, but I'm honored and glad to be here with you. So,
yeah. So, I mean, you know, you are one of our gems. So I don't know why you're being so modest today. But anyway, so today we just want to talk, We like to talk about, you know, your athletes, your athletic experience. In your own words, so there's so much data. We know the statistics. We know all of that. But we want to kind of, you know, give you the opportunity to tell your story in your own words. So let's start from the beginning. Where did you grow up and what was your upbringing like?
Okay. Born and raised in New Orleans for the most part. New Orleans East. Went to school, high school, on the West Bank at Nicar. You know, I took a ride every morning.
So you lived out in the East, but you went to school at Carr?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I was, this is back when Carr was just becoming a high school. And so we went from a middle school to a magnet school. And in that magnet, you could come from anywhere within the city as long as you tested in. And so, you know, it was an entrance exam. You had to test in to be able to come. And I had just moved back from Atlanta. I had been living in Atlanta for about 7 years with my mom. And I was starting high school and came to live with my dad, who at that time was a teacher and a coach at Carr.
Okay.
And he was thinking it was too much for me to go across the river every day. Really, I think he just didn't want me coming to school with him. But he, you know, was enrolling me in other schools closer to home, Brother Martin, St. Augustine, even threatened to send me to Kennedy. The athletic director at the school at that time, who a good friend of his, fraternity brother, is basically like an uncle to me, said, Bernard, that's my dad's name, Bernard, too. We're trying to build a program here, and you got a kid that is 6'2", 200 pounds. Bring him here. Don't send him nowhere else. Don't send him to our competition. Bring him here. And at that time, I wasn't playing football.
So what did you do in middle school?
I didn't do any sports in middle school.
Middle school did you go to?
I went to Southwest Middle School in Atlanta, Georgia.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
Folks that's from the A, they know that school. And then I went for one semester to Benjamin Mays High School, where I did end up playing football my freshman year. But I played other sports. I played baseball. I played basketball. My very first sport was tennis, believe it or not, at Pontchartrain Park. That's where I actually got started with my athletic career.
So
and then I transitioned
right behind
into swimming.
Right behind Suno?
Yeah, right over there. The tennis courts are still there. They keep getting refurbished every now and then over there by Bartholomew.
The golf course.
And yeah, that was the hub for me. I spent all of my time as a kid growing up in Pontchartrain Park at that time at the park.
Okay. So your dad gets talked into letting you go to Carr. So what was that experience like at Carr? Because, you know, you were building, y'all were building a program, right?
Yeah. You know, Carr had a profile and the reputation of being a very good middle school as far as athletics was concerned. Academically, had been a good school historically in Algiers for a while. I had no knowledge of any of this. I just was, you know, going with the flow. Wherever it took me, I was going. Wherever my dad said I was going. As long as they could take this, you know, hard-headed, full of energy, and the very opinionated kid and give him the space that he needed to grow, which Carr did, I went with it. So I ended up there, and, you know, I started off not doing any athletics whatsoever, even though I was recruited by every coach that, you know, was there to try to come out. So I came in the spring, and it was basketball season. So I went out for the basketball team, lasted literally 2 days for a couple practices, and they were like, nah, this ain't for you. You need to go see the football coach.
What were you doing in practice in 2 days that made them think you just needed to get out of the gym?
I was aggressive. You know, like they always tell you, I had good footwork, was quick, can jump, can run, could do all of those things. But
you were probably going to be in foul trouble.
I was used to playing basketball.
You were probably going to be in foul trouble.
Oh, I would have fouled out within the first 5 minutes. Yeah. You know, I was used to playing basketball, pickup basketball on courts in the park where you're a lot more aggressive. You know, fouls, they were far and few between. So, you know, a little pushing and shoving was normalized. And that was not what Rock and Rob, who legends, Carr legends in basketball, wanted. And so they were like, yeah, that's not going to work. So go see Watney. And Don Watney, got rested. So, you know, legendary Carr coach was like, oh, Lord, just bring him here. And so, you know, I went out for football. And, I mean, I was still a goofy 13-year-old kid, didn't know really what my body was doing and still trying to figure that out. And got out there and realized I could just let out all my aggression and anger out here. And so it worked. It became a part of an expression of youth and physicality, but then also became a little bit of therapy. It got all of that anger out on the field in a constructive manner.
What was a 13-year-old angry about back then?
Oh,
they didn't have cell phones and social media. So
no, we didn't have any of that
back then.
But I hated Atlanta. I really did. Atlanta was, and as a New Orleanian, it was never really my thing to be in Atlanta. You know, we moved there because of parent split and opportunity for mom and whatnot, but it just was not that fit for me. It worked well for my sister. Went through high school. She went through Mays as well and then went on to Emory, but it was not conducive for me.
Well, we're glad to have you here in New Orleans.
Yeah.
I know they were super excited.
Everything happens for a reason.
Right. Cool.
Everything happens for a reason.
So, when did you start getting recruited? When did that process start for you?
Oh, good Lord. That didn't happen until mid-season senior year. I had no clue to what this was. I didn't. Nobody else in my family.
So you're literally in your senior year.
Yeah.
And you still not really too much in the process. Okay.
Yeah. Nobody else in my family that we knew of at the time had any experience with this, right? I, first of all, I'm almost a foot taller than everybody else. I was bigger than everybody else. And my parents actually allowed me to play sports. My dad was a great athlete. My mom was a great athlete, record holders. Both of them did their thing in high school. My mom's a legend at 35. My dad held it down at Clark here in the city, but they never went and did anything in college. They, you know, were focused on academics. and they weren't encouraged to do sports. Pretty much my dad told me, hey, if this is going to pay for school, you might want to take them up on their offer because I ain't got it. You know, I'm a public servant. So what I got is I got $5 and a stick of bubble gum. I can see what that does for you. So when the letters started coming in, originally we thought, you know, it's just regular collegiate recruiting where schools are saying, hey, come look at us, check us out, whatnot. So we didn't really pay any attention to the letters coming in from the athletic departments. We didn't know. Then the athletic director at school said, hey, man, I'm getting some calls from these coaches and they saying y'all not responding to them. You know, we didn't have cell phones. Right. Email was not prolific at that time, so letters were it. Or they would call your house or come to the school.
Exactly.
So when they started coming to the school, they were like, yeah, yeah, I want to talk to Bernard Robertson. They thought they were talking about Coach Rob. They wanted to go see my dad, and they were like, no, I want to see the young one. And that kind of opened our eyes to what was happening. And, you know, I was 16 at the time, so we were not anticipating anybody being serious about this. It was middle of the season and folks started coming to see me and talking to me. Everybody's making big promises. So I'm like, all right, let's take them up on their offer to set up visits. We were coming up to that point in the season where you started declaring which visits you were going to take.
Right,
and
right.
You were going to go see and do that. And so, you know, I got a couple big name schools. Their conferences have all changed, but you know, so
what,
a couple
what schools did you
schools,
visit?
Tennessee and LSU and Southern Miss and Texas A&M, and then at the time, young coach. He ain't so young no more. I tell him that all the time. But at the time, a young running backs coach from New Orleans. By the name of Burton Byrne, happened to turn into one of the best coaches in college history, the best recruiting coaches ever, convinced us to add Tulane to the list. And I was sitting there
going, so how did he convince Tulane? You to do that? What was he saying about Tulane? What
yeah,
was his
so
thoughts?
We're on the podcast. I don't really want to repeat what he said. But it was on character and, you know, to the point, you know, to use less colorful words, it was basically, don't go ride the bench trying to wait for 2 years to, you know, play at somebody else's school. Come here, come start right now, come be that difference maker. And, you know, I was like, it's all great hype, but it's too late. Y'all won 2 games last year. What do you want from me? And, I was not initially interested. I was going to pretty much make that commitment to LSU. I had gone up there as one of my visits, had a good time up until my last day of my visit. Had a little bit of an issue that we weren't happy about. It was something that happened away from campus and how the athletic department and how the head coach really at the time handled it. Turned my dad off.
You were on your visit when that happened?
Yeah, yeah.
So you were on your visit, situation arises, you see how they actually handle people and it didn't set well with you?
Yeah, you know, I was getting dropped back off at my hotel from a party that we went to. You usually go out, have a little fun, see the social life. Everything was great. Coming back about 2 or 3 blocks from the hotel, we got stopped by the cops. Anybody that knows me knows this story. I've told it a million times about how we were handled by Baton Rouge Police, how it's, you know, something that was very indicative of what you see so many young black males go through, automatically, you know, deemed a criminal, handled in a way that they would not want anybody to handle their own family.
So who was with you at that time you got stopped? Like, what was the makeup of the group?
Yeah. So the two starting defensive ends, believe it or not, at LSU, which I was being recruited for that particular position. I was a defensive end linebacker type that was going to play there. And, you know, I'm not going to say
it was all students. So it was all students.
Yeah, it was students. But okay. It was one of their cars that we were driving in, and we were surrounded by about a dozen cops or so when they basically accused us of carjacking somebody and then running from the scene in the car. And wow. Once he proved that, you know, it was his vehicle, we were already.
So these were two LSU people that are on LSU's team at the time.
Yeah, current players, current stars. Had just won the game. I mean, it was a big game. Played Florida, beat Florida. We go out after the game and you're flying high, and then you have this as a huge low, you know.
So what wound up happening? Did they take you guys, or did they run the plates and realize it wasn't? How far did it go?
Had us on the ground, basically them near stripped, me on our neck, gun to the temple, screaming at us, asking us where the woman was that we carjacked, while the owner of the vehicle, the player that was the owner, was telling them, look in the glove box to show you my registration, my license is in my wallet, in my pocket. You could call my dad, who is, you know, the registered owner of the car. Everything, you know, could.
I mean, I'm looking at you, Bernard, and I'm feeling like if I saw you in the streets, I would know you were a football player.
Well, I was a lot smaller at that time.
I'm just
time.
Saying, if it's
but
a bunch
they weren't,
of y'all they together, that's what I mean. Right. You guys together, yeah. it had to be obvious that.
Well, that was part of what it is that, you know, my dad didn't feel comfortable with. There obviously was some sort of understanding, but being the psyche and the mindset of what they were going through, they were looking to prove a point. And we had hoped that it would all get cleared up after they let us go. You know, my dad is.
So y'all didn't. They didn't take. They didn't take y'all in. They didn't take y'all in.
No.
Okay.
No,
so would that have happened? Since that happened to you, did you have any other experiences like that before or after? Or how does it make you feel when you see that that is still going on today?
Yeah, I did not have anything to that extreme. I mean, as a big black man in the South, I have had more than my fair share of run-ins with certain, you know, egotistical officers. I've had more than my fair share of good interactions as well. But it is frustrating that it mainly comes out of bias and bigotry and laziness, right? Because simply running the tags before you decide to stop us, surround us, pull out your guns would have been sufficient. They definitely didn't need to go to the extreme, the physical extremes that they did. You know, that was overkill. Anything since my interactions, typically was the same thing. It was, I see somebody who's big and black, I want to be antagonistic as far as my interaction with them and see where it's going to go. And, you know, just trying to provoke a response. It's sad to see that continues, because it has to do with everything about the quality of the officer that was in that situation. Because like I said, I've had the opposite.
Exactly.
I've sat on boards with police chiefs and with officers and worked hand in hand with them and doing certain things within communities. And you get a completely different person because they're trying to accomplish a goal, not necessarily, you know, prove a point.
So how does that interaction, I know you have kids, does that interaction impact how you communicate that situation with your kids? Did you feel like you needed to have the talk?
Yeah. I've had the pleasure of raising two boys who are in college now.
And they're nice size. They're not little right. bitty people.
And from that, you know, we during the pandemic, during the era of what happened to George Floyd, we have had to, you know, and Philando Castile and so many others, we've had to go through and have this conversation. They were in high school at the time that this was taking place, so they wanted to know why. Why would this be something that happened? Then, you know, I would have to share my story and my history of my interactions with officers. And I also would need to tell them, hey, you're about to start driving. You're about to start going places without your mom and dad. This is what you have to be prepared for. This is how you have to conduct yourself. And this is what you need to stay away from. You know, and it's hard for them because they're growing up in a more privileged environment than I even did, than their grandparents did, you know. And as that privilege comes on, it's hard for them to understand that they have to self, you know, check themselves when it comes to certain things that their friends don't have to, simply because they are a young Black male in the South, in the city. And, you know, they're driving a car where most kids their age wouldn't necessarily even have access to a car, let alone a driver's license. And they have these privileges. So how they had to be hyper aware of that as possibilities and how to conduct it.
Yeah, our kids have a lot to go through.
Yeah, they
you
do.
Know, even in terms of them, you know, again, having a privilege and you know, having had some advantages that maybe some other kids haven't had, it's still amazing that you have to still have that talk with them today in these times. And even, you know, when they are choosing their friends, like, you know, you have to have that conversation with them about, you know, the people that you going out with and what that could potentially have. Yeah, that's truly interesting. So that kind of explains a little of the aggression that comes up. I mean,
oh, it definitely,
that never leaves you, right?
That chip was on my shoulder for a long time. And, you know, I was able to channel it and use it as fuel for, you know, during my playing career. It got me more than my fair share of, you know, 15-yard penalties, but I always would say I would make up for it. Okay. I would get them, but I would make up for it. And I never forget Tommy Bowden, second coach here at Tulane, told me, look, I know you're going to get it early and make it good. That's what he would tell me, right? Just go ahead and get the penalty so we can recover quickly from it, but make it good. And I take that to heart. I carried that kind of thought process with me all the way into the NFL and did the exact same thing. Now, they didn't look at it the same way, but I approached it in the same manner.
Well, thanks to some, you know, overzealous officers in Baton Rouge, you kept your recruiting process open. So how did it steer to Tulane?
So Tulane was going to be an unofficial visit for me. Because I was holding out. Coming up as a kid, I, you know, watched college football. If I was going to play college football, I had Michigan, Notre Dame that was shoved down my face. You couldn't tell. I was, you know, in Atlanta, I was a middle schooler wearing a Michigan starter jacket. And for those of us who were, you know, kids of the 90s, starter jackets were everything, right?
Right, right.
So I wanted to go to University of Michigan, and I was dead set on that. I wanted to go, whether it was academics or athletics, you name it, that's where I wanted to go. So I was holding out the hope that they would make a offer. And, you know, we were in communication. They never made the offer. But so I had a open weekend, and LSU was the preceding visit, and on the way back, I never forget. We didn't have cell phones readily available to us back then. So on the way back from Baton Rouge on the visit, my dad pulls over and stops at a payphone, back when they still had payphones. And we called Burton Burns, and Burton got on the phone. And again, more colorful language. I told you you needed to leave them alone and just bring your butt here. So I'm putting you down for an official visit next week. You're coming. And, it was interesting. I got back home. We had a game that week. We had a game that week. And then we went uptown and went to do a visit. Started the visit off. It was incredible. Buddy Tevens was the head coach at that time.
Okay.
And Buddy was one of those guys, you know, another one that we lost too early.
Great person, that was kind of tragic. Yeah.
Man of substance and honor. And, you know, when he looked you in your eyes and he told you he was going to do something, it was it. And he had expectations of you. So it was a different feel than what I thought was like pompous, you know, dude that was the LSU head coach. He was more authentic. And so my dad picked up on that. My stepmom, she was on a visit with us. She picked up on that, and we were like, all right, we like it. Then they took me to one of my favorite, what became one of my favorite steakhouses, Charlie's Uptown.
Okay.
Hole in the wall, not an endorsement by any means, but they're good. went there, had a good time. Then parents separated. They went to go talk with coaches. I got to go hang out with my host, which I had two hosts again. I don't know how I got so lucky, but I ended up having Sean King, ironically.
Oh, my goodness.
A host, and Kapoor Conley. So
Sean's older than you?
Yeah, Sean was 2 years ahead of me, and Kapoor was... I want to say a year ahead of me.
Okay.
They were my host, and we leave. It's the city. If you're going to a party, it's not like in Baton Rouge where stuff is going to start a little earlier because it's going to end at 2. Stuff started a lot later here. So, you know, pre-gaming, before we went out, we went to go hang with some upperclassmen at Stadium Place.
Okay.
Walk in the room and you got guys who have now become like big brothers to me who never, some of them I never
who,
even
who
got a chance
to. Who were some of the guys that were there for your pregame?
Oh, wow. Oh, whoo, goodness. All right. So,
I know you guys are close. That your group is a really tight knit group. So,
yeah.
A couple of the guys that stood out
Don
during
Jackson
that
visit. And Bam. And Gooch and Daryl Jackson. I'm sorry, I'm using nicknames. All right. Thaddeus Prosper and T. Cook, Terrence Cook. Goodness, again,
it's hard not to call the nicknames. All of y'all were getting together to go out. This is tea talk, so you can use nicknames for tea talk. This is not.
This is not
official.
So, you know, Stadium Place was that apartment, and you had guys that were sitting on the couch with the table playing they were playing card game there. I think it was spades. Then you had guys sitting at the table, the kitchen table, and they were playing bones. And so for me, as a black kid walking in and seeing this, I was like, no HBCU. offered me. No HBCU was interested. As a matter of fact, all the HBCUs that did come to school recruited my backups.
Okay.
And I was like, you know, again, I'm a kid of the 90s, so I came up
did
with
they
a different
just think
world.
You weren't going to come to the
yeah.
school?
Okay. Yeah, they
thought you
I
were
would
too big
take a visit,
for...
enjoy it, but yeah. then, you know, commit to a larger school. Shows they didn't really know me, but, you know, I wanted that the closest thing to a black experience, HBCU experience, as possible. I grew up watching A Different World. I got to hang out with my cousins who, when I was in middle school in Atlanta, they were at Morehouse and Morris Brown. So I got to have that feel hanging out with them. I wanted that, but didn't get that offer. Walking into that apartment at Stadium Place was the closest thing I had. And that just right there, that feeling. And then when somebody lost, inviting me to sit down and play dominoes with them, I'm sitting there, oh, okay, again, 16-year-old kid about to sit here and play with some 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And I got school. I thought I knew how to play. I learned a lot that day, but it just felt like home. The rest of the visit went really, really similar to that. It was guys welcoming me in, not standoffish. You know, a lot of that had to do with Buddy brought in some local guys at the time. He also brought in a lot of guys from Florida. So that was that Louisiana and Florida feel that we can get. And then he stacked on some guys from Texas. And then oddly enough, he brought in guys from New York, which, hey, they're Southerners now by default because some of them never left. But that nucleus that Buddy built, those were the guys that not only made our 1998 team be what it is, but they made the guys who came in 96, 97, 98, they made us into the men that we are, because those were true brothers, because they were there during the struggle, right?
Right.
And that was something that was really cool. Ironically, after that first night, I told my dad, I said, I think I want to come to Tulane. He was like, what? He was not expecting that, right? He wasn't expecting me to make my decision that early. He said, hold off. Let's finish the visit. Let's talk to coach and we'll do it. And so finished out the visit. Tulane was the only school that showed me a classroom, right? We took a visit to the building where my intended major, the dean, was housed. Most of the classes were housed, and we got to meet a couple of the professors. For an educator, that's all my dad needed. So now my dad is sold. My mom was already on board. My mom was, you know, getting updates every night from afar. My mom was biased. My mom is a Tulane alum, so she wanted me to go anyway. And I thoroughly enjoyed it to the point where when they were like, all right, who wants to be up first to go meet with coach? I'm like, all right here, right here. I'm ready to meet with them. Went in, talked with Buddy, told him we were happy to come. It was good. It was really good. It was a good decision. I had followed in the footsteps of two other car guys who had already taken their visits and committed, Jerry Phillips and Noel Ellis. Okay. We played multiple sports together at Carr, had a couple championships together as well. And I was like, if they're going, I'm going. And we had an intent where we were going to have two other guys go with us as well. David Watkins, another guy that's good friend, teammate, God rest his soul, and Jimmy Ferguson, who was one of the coldest linebackers I've ever seen. Unfortunately, it didn't go the way he wanted for him. Jimmy wanted to come to Tulane, but they offered another guy over him, and Jimmy went to Nichols State. And David was my roommate, ironically, on my visit to LSU, and he committed to LSU and was trying to get me to commit at the same time. I was like, yeah, I can see it. Our thoughts and goals were we're going to be the two replacement defensive ends to the guys who had hosted us. And it just didn't work out that way. But we were going to be the Fab Five. That was our thought process. It didn't happen, but three of us did make it to Tulane, and one went to LSU and one went to Nichols State. And that was just, you know, the five of us that played defense. For those of us that played offense coming out of Carr, because I played both ways. Senior year, I don't know what I was on, but, you know, we had a number of guys go to Alabama State. We had some guys go to Southern. We had some guys go to Southern Miss. We had a pretty large signing class for a school that had only been competing as a high school in LHSAA for 4 years at that time. And it was, no, we've had some notable players coming up. Yeah.
That's amazing. And I think people look at Carr because of the academics, so they know they're getting a good student as well. So
yeah, kind of yeah I mean, back then it was a lot like Tulane in that regard, where we had a serious cutoff for academics, where you can easily get put on probation and get sat down if your GPA dropped. And if you approached a C-minus average, you might get put out of the school. So you had to be disciplined. You had to be smart. You also had to be very focused on balancing academics and athletics. So we practically lived at the school. You know, folks would, the bell would ring at 3:00. Most folks would start heading out, and we would go right to another classroom, start working on ACT, SAT prep, getting homework done, getting tutoring, whatever it was, and then we would practice. But yeah, they made sure that we were prepared for going to the next level, so that when we got to Tulane, our intent was not to just play ball, but to also graduate and have success with, you know, a good degree that would carry us for the next 40 years. So that Tulane model is not a 4-year decision, it's a 40-year decision really applied in that regard.
Yeah, that's a great model in terms of what high schools should do to help prepare their student athletes. I don't really understand why they don't do that at other places as well, on a you know, a more a higher level than what is done right now.
I understand it either. There's a couple that are out there. I know, just giving a shout out, and yes, I am biased. They got programs out there that got guys that have come from Carr, duplicated. A lot of the head coaches around the city are Carr products. You also got some guys that are Tulane products that are doing something similar. You know, Jerry Phillips over at Warren Easton, you know, high school and college teammate of mine, is doing a great job with guys doing that. He just, he's got one kid that's probably going to be first, second round draft pick this year as an offensive lineman. And that's huge, right? He's got a couple other guys that he's been able to develop like that. But then you've got guys who have been developed at other programs at, well, back when it was Landry Walker, you've got Carver and McMain and a couple other schools all around the city where you've had Carr products and guys who have touched Tulane in some ways, because we've got quite a few former student-athletes at Tulane that are local coaches as well, who are putting those programs together and putting those guys out there.
That's incredible, and good to know. So, going through this, you made mm-hmm. your decision. You're on campus. What was your first day on campus, officially
it was interesting.
On campus?
One, at that time, I didn't have a car. So I had to come from the east during the summer. I started summer workouts. And I had...
Who were your strength training coaches?
Oh, Lord. now, see, now you're asking the tough question.
Was Coach Roll,
no.
Was Coach Roll
no.
still there?
Goodness. Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to have to work out that part of my brain and let that come back out.
we'll leave that one.
It'll
we'll
come
leave that
the
one
most
alone.
Inopportune
so you're
time
on campus
to
work.
But I had
I
a teammate, another
them.
Guy who was coming from local school, who was coming out of Chalmette. We played against each other in high school. Glenn Lemoyne, defensive end, and coach just connected us. And Glenn was like, "Yeah, I got to come out of the parish, so I'll just swing by on I-10, drop off, pick you up, and we keep on going to workouts." And Glenn and I ended up becoming real good friends because of that, still good friends to this day. And we got on campus, and that first first day, whew, it was like, you know, I wouldn't equate it and belittle what happens with basic training in the military, but it was close, right? They just dropped us in the fire. It was like, you know, going from A to B, running full speed to get there, getting screamed at, you know, them forcing everybody to do everything together. And if anybody was like,
so what was the record? What was the record the season before you got there? 2-9. So the urgency was on.
Yeah, because I mean, again, a 16-year-old wouldn't truly understand this at that time. It wasn't, you know, 24-hour sports news where they can track and keep up with everybody and what's going on. Back then, you found out after the fact what was happening, not like you have insiders and everybody today. So as a 16-year-old, I had no clue that Buddy was on the bubble, that if he did not have a turnaround season, that more than likely he was getting fired. That 2-9 season, they had great talent. They played some very, very close games. Most of the games they lost very close, by three or less points. And so, you know, the nucleus was there. There was just something that was missing. And unfortunately, it didn't materialize in the 96 season either.
Okay.
I was, you know, suited up and dressing out for three of the games. And then the third, right when the fourth game was coming up and they were about to get on the plane, I was told I was being redshirted. So I wasn't, you know, going to travel anymore with the team. Get used to wearing street clothes.
How did that make you feel?
It was an adjustment, right? Had never had that before.
So when you were playing the games, were you playing a lot of downs? Like, were you getting the reps in during the games?
No,
or was it just out of the blue?
Like one or two special teams plays just going, which I had not played special teams ever before. And so that was interesting. But once I was redshirted and having to stand on the sidelines, it was foreign territory for me, right? I was used to being a starter. I was used to getting in and getting some work and contributing to the win and very few losses. And I'm standing in a warm-up suit on the sideline, and we kept having losses. Right. And it was frustrating because we were close on a number of those. And then 2 weeks to go left in the season, and we get the notification Buddy's getting fired. And that was something that was also foreign. Right. For me, head coach in high school, longtime head coach. He was, you know, head coach until he retired. Any of my previous coaches in other sports, whatever it is, they were just the coaches. They were there. They didn't, you know, get let go. So this was foreign territory. And with that, Buddy pulled off the handcuffs. He was like, okay, well, y'all go ahead. We were playing LSU as the last game of the season. I wished I had the opportunity to play in that game because that would have been a good revenge game for me.
Right.
But they went out there and showed really what that team had in their hearts. Way bigger than most people anticipated. They went out there and they beat the you-know-what out of LSU.
Okay.
Except for a few calls that didn't go, you know, the Wave's way. They win the game. They win the game in great fashion. I mean, literally. You had guys like Gerald Soule went out there and pretty much punched his ticket to the NFL by showing the SEC team from his backyard. This is what a running back looks
yes.
like. You know, you had a couple others that went out there and showcased their talents as well and proved that it wasn't just, you know, the smart school downriver. This is what Tulane football could be. So when Buddy was let go, Tommy Bowden was hired and he was brought in. Tommy actually inherited a very seasoned team with a whole lot of talent. And the talent
How did you guys feel about Tommy coming in? Like once he
came, first it was apprehension. We were like, Bowden's coming in. We were like, who?
Not Bobby Bowden.
Bowden from Florida State. I know he's not taking a job at Tulane. What's going on there? And like, no, his son. So we thought Terry Bowden was coming in. And they're like, no, he was at Auburn at the time. Not that one, the other son. I'm like, who? Tommy. Okay. So we had to go do some research and find out Tommy. All right, Tommy came in, and boy, he came in with that Bowden swagger. He was, came in, and one of the first things he said, team meeting, he said, I want y'all to look around. Started scratching. He would always, when he was about to deliver bad news, he'd scratch his elbow. And so he was looking, I want you to look around. I want you to see everybody that's here. Some of y'all not going to be here next year. And we're like, what? We on scholarship. We're going to be here unless you, we're thinking unless as a player, you screwed up, you'll be here. I said, I need scholarships. I need to build the team. And some of y'all, you know who you are. You taking up space. That didn't become evident what he meant until we made it to fall camp. All through the spring, everybody was getting evaluated. That spring and summer was a real test, but that fall was something else. That spring, we got introduced to a young strength coach. You talk about who, I completely forgot who it was before under Buddy. But the guy came in that really made a spark in not just the physical aspect of what guys were doing, but the mental and spiritual aspect as well was Coach Mike Iasia, who was the strength and conditioning coach. And he was a young guy at the time. Maybe 10 years older than, the average player at the time. So he was in his 20s, and he got the chance to mold us physically into what Coach wanted. He was like, look, we're smaller than most teams because we just don't have 6'8" offensive linemen, 300 and whatever pounds. We got to make it work. So he wanted to go with speed. Like, we're going to be faster than everybody else, and we're going to be out-conditioned than everybody else as well, better shape, and we're going to jab them to death. We're just going to keep on hitting them until they quit. And that's exactly what we did. During that summer, I was actually asked, would I be okay with moving from defense to offense? And they had starters. They had upperclassmen that were starters. And I was coming in as a redshirt freshman, and I said, sure. Whatnot. I played offensive line in high school as well. I'll go. So they moved myself and Dominic Crockett. We were two redshirt freshmen. They moved us from defensive line to offensive line. And then because of the offense that they were going to run, it was not really tight end specific. There wasn't going to be a lot of work for the tight end to do. So to get him reps, although he wasn't too happy about it, they moved one of our all-conference tight ends, Corey Geeson, they moved him to tackle. And so the face of the offensive line shifted drastically. It went from a lot of big guys where power was going, there was going to be an attempt for power, to a more of a mixture of speed and endurance on the offensive line, because we had to move. We would run 60 to 70 plays a game in the offense that Bowden brought with Rich Rodriguez, who was our offensive coordinator, who was, the mastermind behind what became a lot of that spread offense that, dominated the late 90s and early 2000s. Everybody was copying off of what Rich Rod was able to create with us, because we went from being a relatively unknown team, 120th in ranking, to the next, and you know, 2-9 1 year to the very next year going 7-5. And they were like, okay, now we're, you know, create that blip on the radar. Sean King was a quarterback. You know, we had Juwan Dawson and P.J. Franklin at wide receiver and Jamegan D'Artes at running back. And now you have this offensive line that was also being, you know, required to make plays downfield. So it wasn't three steps, give him 3 seconds, and he'd get rid of the ball. We were flying around making additional blocks. We did a lot of tosses to the sideline, throws to the sideline that were like running plays, but they would go to the wide receiver. And, you know, those kind of plays became a staple now in offense, but nobody was really doing it back then until we were, and we were able to do that because of the offensive line and the talent at receiver and running back that we had. Those were some really good guys who, in the traditional schemes, probably would not have saw the numbers that they put up simply because they didn't fit that mold. But then Rich Rod created an offense that fit us instead of trying to fit us to the offense. We put up some big numbers.
So they did so he did a really good job of innovating and working to the strengths of the people that he had there. And that he felt like they could recruit in, you know, right?
Not only building that, but on the recruiting trail, obviously trying to get more talent that modeled after what we had there at the time. So you didn't see these guys come in at offensive line where they were 6'7", 6'8", 340 pounds, you know, like typically see at Alabama or whatnot like that, because it wasn't going to be 3 yards in a cloud of dust. It was going to be...
So they're not filling space. They have to move and go.
We did a lot of scheme blocking. Gotcha. We did a lot of option blocking where it looked like a run and turn into a pass. We had a... they call it RPO now, run pass option, but that was spread offense. That's what we did. We gave the quarterback, Sean, at the time, the ability to do just about anything. There was always 2 to 3 plays rolled into one play every time we snapped the ball. And so that was part of the genius of Rich Rod and what he was able to do. And then on recruiting trail, again, we had Dick Hopkins and we had Burton Burns being able to bring talent in that complemented that and just keep that going. So when 98 came, you know, we were even better than we were in 97, which people were really excited about. 97 went from 2-9 to 7-5, right? Except that they didn't know what made us that good in 98, because it was virtually the same starters that were in 97. But it was the fact that Tommy turned down going to a bowl game.
Okay.
It was the first bowl game in a while for Tulane football to go to, and Tommy turned it down. He said, one, it was a brand new bowl game. It was the Idaho Bowl. That's when they came up with the Smurf turf up there, blue turf, so that they can actually see the field when it snowed. He didn't want to go to that. Plus, he said we weren't ready. And, you know, in our heads, we were pissed off. We wanted to go to a bowl game. We wanted to go play. But we weren't ready. But that created that chip on our shoulder. And we carried that chip all offseason. We practiced like we were pissed off. We practiced to the point where Scott Cowan was coming in as the new president of Tulane. And we're having a fall practice right before the season starts at home, back on the practice field where now Humans Stadium sits. And we have a inner squad scuffle, a fight. It started with just two guys pushing on each other. Then it started with coaches fussing at each other. And then it turned into an all out brawl between everybody. As Tommy is walking...
y'all had pads on?
Oh, yeah. It was full contact. So this was all... When I say all out, it was roommates going at each other and friends, you know, right. just clashing. It was no holds barred. Right. Coaches going after each other, right? It was just all of that.
All the frustration was coming out.
And you got Scott Cowan walking in with a blue and green suit on, face painted, hair dyed, all of this, because he's just coming through from this big ceremony where they did his investiture, and he's looking at us like, what the hell? Like, what is this? And lo and behold, you know, Tommy stopped it. Tommy wasn't breaking right. up anything. He just said, hey, everybody calm down. We all started looking at each other, started right. laughing, right? It was, we got out right. what we needed to get out, but it also set the tone for how were we going to approach that season. That was lightning in the bottle, right? That was one of those times where you get lucky to capture that, and that closeness built up off of that carried us through just wanting to, you know, beat the snot out of every team we played, regardless of what the conditions were that year, who was supposed to win, whatever. So we entered that season still unranked. I think we had moved up from like 120th something to maybe being in the 80s because we, you know, we had a winning season. So now we were ahead of all of the other right. losing teams, except for a few. And we were in the high 80s or something like that. And we started winning. And we would win in dramatic fashion to the point where, you know, we were putting up 20, 30, sometimes 40 points up ahead of spread on our opponents. So that would move us up and we would get excited. We look at the newspaper all the time. Oh, we jumped into the 70s. We jumped into the 60s. Now we're in the 50s. Oh, man, we're halfway there to being ranked in the top 25. And so then midway through the season, we started getting ranked in the top 25, and you started to feel the whole atmosphere around right. the city change. You know, we playing in the dome at that time, and we used to get 10 to 15,000 coming to the game. We started getting 30, 40, 50,000 coming into the games, and we were like, hold on, we got something. And now we've got the city, you know, at our backs. We've got some momentum going in the nation when it comes to football. Teams were ready for us. Teams were preparing for us instead of getting caught off guard by, oh, they thought we were the homecoming team every week. Now you got to prepare for us. And when you had guys who were getting talked about as being number one draft picks, and several of them were, and they had to face us, and, you know, we put that pounding on them, and they admitted we were the real deal. We find ourselves creeping up into, you know, in the season in the top 10. I think eventually we ended up at number 7 overall. Probably should have been higher. We still contend that we should have played for that national championship because we were undefeated. But, hey, if college football was fair, it would be so. You know, we're in March Madness right now where playing in basketball, you win, you end, it's one and done when it comes to losses. If that were the case when it came to football, a true playoff system, I think we would have been playing Tennessee or Florida State for that national championship.
So when you come to Tulane, you have expectations about yourself and how you want your career to go. How did the expectations that you have for yourself correlate to what actually happened?
Believe it or not, I didn't have any. Like I said, I was still a kid.
You were what, 16 coming on campus?
Around. Yeah.
That's really young.
So I just wanted to have fun. I was like,
did you have fun, Bernard?
I go to school because that's expected. I had fun. I had a lot of fun. I mean, everything from, you know, being able to be there with my best friends and win and, you know, create an atmosphere of winning to meeting my wife, you know, at school to create, you know, having my kids as godparents and everything else. That time, those 5 years that I was on campus really did solidify a lot of what life became. So I didn't have expectations, but I got a lot out of it. I know I came in thinking, okay, I'm going to follow in everybody else's footsteps in my family, in my generation, and go be a doctor. So I was setting up to do that. And thankfully, you had Dr. Brunet and Dr. Stewart and a couple other doctors who were around the athletic program that were guiding me on that and had me under their wing, and I could have done that. But I ended up running into a guy by the name of ML Lagarde, who was, you know, he was just ML when I saw him around the Wilson Center. Yeah, definitely a legend. But, you know, as an 18-year-old kid, he was just ML. Saw him walking in, he scoot in, took his time, shake hands with everybody, spoke to everybody, could remember damn near everything about anybody he met. And it was just by chance. I actually had gotten in a little bit of trouble on campus I parked in the wrong parking spot.
Whose parking spot did you park in?
It wasn't anybody's specifically. It was a metered spot, but time had ran out, and I was there for a while, and they were coming to try to put a boot on my car. So I had some choice words for the officer, and I was trying to get in my car and drive off before he could get the boot out, and he grabbed me and was like, oh, that's a no-no. Luckily, my teammates were there to intervene. So, you know, lesson had to be learned. So I was given some community service and some other stuff to do. And I ended up being connected with ML in doing that. And while doing that with him, I learned a lot from him. A lot about business, a lot about networking and relationships and how those things go. And that was probably as educational as what I was learning up campus in school. He showed me a lot. And so my focus became business then after that. I still finished with the pre-med concentration. But then I was able, because of my fifth year, to double major. So I was adding additional things and started focusing on business, which ended up becoming a good thing for me because, again, completely in my head, just having fun, kid on campus, was not paying attention to anything talking about NFL. It was furthest from my mind until, you had guys start coming to work out, a couple of receivers, a couple guys who were being talked about going to the NFL. And coaches would request to have me come over and do a workout with them. And I was like, okay, so they're looking at me for what, though? During my tenure at Tulane, I had played multiple positions, so I was trying to figure out what it is that they wanted me to do specifically. And I'll never forget, it was Mike Tice from Minnesota. I think he eventually became Minnesota's head coach as well, but he was the offensive line coach. And he was like, look, I need somebody that I can put in any position and you just go in and play. And I think that's you. I said, okay. He got the ball started and now I'm in my head. This is happening. Then I start, getting a couple more workouts, and then I get after our season, which was my first losing season. Well, not losing, but we didn't win more than six games. This was 2000.
Oh, okay, 2 years.
Yeah.
So this was after Tommy's
gone, and now we have Chris Selfo, which was a complete 180 as far as style and how we went about stuff. So there was less mesh when it came to what I did and what he wanted and how that worked. So I wasn't really thinking about NFL. I was thinking we'd just be lucky to, get out of here with a winning record collegiately, because we didn't perform the same. So I'll leave it at that. but, you know, guys started talking about, you know, you getting drafted. And so towards the end of the season, I started getting some letters. I got a letter from the East-West Shrine Game inviting me to come play out west after the season was over. And was at that point, was pretty much like, hey, let me take a trip out west. Hadn't been out to California in a minute. Let me go out there and play in the East-West Shrine Game. And was about to commit to it. And then I ended up getting an agent. My parents got me an agent right after that. And the agent said, nope, hold up. You're going to play in the Senior Bowl. So I said, all right, well, cool. I took the invite and went and played in the Senior Bowl instead. So I went to Mobile, which was good. Got to get to Mobile and showed out a little bit. It didn't hurt that I had, you know, some future Hall of Fame talent right behind me. It's not hard blocking for LaDainian Tomlinson when he's running behind you. Because people start focusing right on where he's going and not you being there. And that gave me an upper hand in blocking and whatnot. But, you know, star-studded Senior Bowl. We had some guys that were there. Some guys that should have been Hall of Famers, but careers went kind of left. But big names nonetheless. Good time. And while there, I was courted by two teams in particular, the Green Bay Packers and the Saints. So I was just like, okay, I'm either going to the frozen tundra and be very cold, but, you know, I'm like, oh, Brett Favre's there. Right. That's fine. You know, a couple guys that I knew had gone up there. And so I was like, it may not be bad. They were after me pretty hard. We did all kinds of numerous interviews. Same thing with the Saints. And it was like, well, I guess it's just meant for me to stay home. And we were going to look at that. And fast forward a couple months later, the draft is there. And neither team wow drafts me. I got drafted completely out the blue by the okay Chicago Bears. So that I was not expecting that. Yeah, yeah. Bears are an interesting team. Historic franchise.
Super Bowl in Chicago, right?
No, I have not had the pleasure of winning a Super Bowl, unfortunately. No Super Bowl.
No Super Bowl? What's the highest your team's finished?
NFC in? Championship. Yeah. A nemesis from college came back. We were actually the first seed, had a first round bye, started doing everything, including creating and retaping, and God, I hope that never sees the light of day. The Super Bowl shuffle, we brought it back, and you know, we were having fun with it. We were flying high. We were 13-3 that season, so we had a really good team led by our defense. Our defense was lights out. And, you know, we just knew we were Super Bowl bound. And then we ran into Donovan McNabb and the Philadelphia Eagles. And I watched him do the same thing he did in college, which was when the game was on the line and they were about to lose, he just found a way to muscle through it. And in front of his hometown in Chicago, he came back and beat us and knocked us out of the playoffs. So, yeah, that's the highest that we've been. Outside of that, the other two not teams I played there on. Nah. Good people on the teams.
Yeah. So how did you adjust from being a professional athlete?
I was out in Oakland with the Raiders, and I was in my hotel room because I hadn't moved into my apartment, and I was just contemplating, where's my heart now? This was my fourth year, okay, and I had gotten injured, and you know, I'm trying to get it in my head, am I going to push through this injury and try to play out my contract. It was good money, very good money. But, you know, knowing that I would have to have my second knee surgery on the same knee and try to push back and make, you know, something out of that. Or do I utilize these degrees I got from Tulane and go do something else? And, you know, I had just had my first child, and wife and kid were back home, and here in New Orleans, we had built a house here, and they were here, and I was thinking, sitting here being isolated away from the team while I rehab, being isolated away from my family because they're back, you know, over 1,000 miles away, I have to make a decision. And so I chose the family, and when I came back home, I thought, I'll take some time off and try to figure out what I want to do, enjoy, you know, playing around with the kid, and then I'll go into the workforce. Well, I had a financial advisor, and he was good for when I was playing. I didn't pay a lot of attention to what he was doing. I had a lot of help from my dad and uncle regarding that, so we kept him, you know, in check, but he just wasn't doing everything that I was going to need now that I was paying more attention to it. So I shopped around for a new advisor, and in the way I was questioning the potential candidates, one of the guys, his manager, came to me and said, obviously, you know your stuff. You're very versed in this. When you're done playing football for good, you hang up your sneakers, I got an office for you. And so I ended up taking him up on that offer a little less than 3 months after he made that offer, and started in the financial advisor training program at Legg Mason here in New Orleans, and went through that training program a few months, came out, and you know, most folks don't graduate from the program. They get into it, and then for one reason or another, they don't make it because it's pretty high pressure. I was able to make it and thrived well. And so I kept adding different specialties and designations to the services I provided and the skill set that I had, and eventually worked my way to building my own company over the years. So that was approximately 20 years ago now. I had a young guy. I was just introduced to him. I played with his high school coach in Chicago, and he was introducing me to him. And I think he's a sophomore on the team now at Tulane. And he's from a suburb of Dallas, and he was asking me all of these questions about, you know, how Tulane was back in the day before they started winning. I said, whoa, time out. We have always won. It just was inconsistent because of one thing or another, whether it was instability in coaching or it was constantly fighting with the administration on whether or not they were keeping sports or not. And that was all of it.
Did you finish up the advice for the students?
For the guy that is currently playing, no. We started a conversation, and then I got called into a meeting, but I told him that I planned on being there for the spring game, get to meet him face-to-face. His coach was my teammate in Chicago, and so we've remained close. We were all rookies together, so we've remained close since our rookie year. And he was like, he's one of the good guys, and he actually was the influence for him coming to Tulane, because he said he, personality wise, he reminded him of, the kid reminded him a lot of me. So he thought that it would be a good fit since Tulane was recruiting. And I try to give back to the kids whenever I can. If they coaches will have me. I usually come. I try to impart a little bit of business and financial wisdom onto them, because that's one of the things I wish more of us had earlier.
Exactly.
You know, especially with the way things are now with the NIL.
Yeah, tell me what you think about the NIL and that whole process. What do you think about it? Especially from your wealth management perspective.
Yeah. In concept, I think it's a great idea. You know, it's something that started back under the time in which I was playing, where we were speaking about getting access to this. Because back then, if, you know, you just took the jersey off of your back and you sold it to somebody for a couple $100 just so you could make that month's rent, you had the potential for being suspended or declared ineligible to play.
Right.
But then you could see a school turn around and sell your jersey for, you know, a couple thousand to put into their coffers. And so watching the NIL come around during the time where you had video games dominating, back when I was playing, when you got into the NFL, you would get a check. You would get a residual, basically image and likeness check from each one of the licensed vendors. So if it was Nike, if it was EA Sports, it was, you know, whoever it was, when it came to, if they utilized that Players Inc. collective license agreement, everybody got a check. And that was probably one of the smartest things ever, because everybody who wanted to use a player, even if they just wanted, say they saw the top 50 and that's right, all they wanted, and they just wanted to pay them, that's not fair, because the top 50 in a team sport wouldn't be who they are without the other guys playing. And so it went across the board and everybody got a check. Now, of course, not all checks were equal,
right,
but everybody got a check. And to see some of that make its way to the collegiate level and some in higher school, where these institutions making money off of the kids can now make some, especially to help their families in some form of way, like any other student would, right? Because if they were just a you know, good chemistry student or engineering student,
right,
or history student, and they were working on a research project or getting co-authored with a professor, they can earn money.
Exactly.
They would not invalidate their academic career. So having athletes be able to share in that as well should not invalidate their career. It should not be restrained either. So they should be able to make as much as they possibly can. The only thing that I would like to see is that there be more of uniformity when it comes to across the board what can and cannot be done. And that's just so that the playing field is leveled in schools.
And then also the athletes should be protected.
Absolutely. Part of that protection is financial literacy. Part of that protection is having access to financial tools where they can not say, okay, we're going to cut you a check and it's going to go into your bank account. Because one of the things that has come as a surprise to a lot is taxes, right? How they receive the money, how they're having to pay back taxes, how it affects their family and their family's income. A lot of that stuff had not been considered with NIL. But again, I do like it. I think that something that can be a useful tool in helping student athletes, especially those who more than likely aren't going to continue into a pro sport. Those who are great support players, those who may end up getting injured and not being able to move on, or those that play a specific sport where there isn't a, you know, a pro league for them to go on and play in, or their league is not as, you know, revenue producing,
right,
but it's larger in college, allow them to make that money. Allow them to get that, you know, get the bag now, but then protect them and show them how to get the bag so that this money affects them not just now, but for the rest of their life.
Exactly. Yeah, that was some great insight in terms of that. Yeah, because it's important, but at the same time, what about the transfer portal? Like, people are in and out the transfer portal. How does that impact their future and, you know, decisions down the road? How do you think that transfer portal is impacting just sports in general?
Speaking from a student athlete that was about to transfer myself, you know, back when Tommy Bowden left for Clemson, I had completed my transfer papers and I was gone. Like I said, and it's widely known, Salford and I did not get along. So I was heading out. I understand the need and desire for, you know, the transfer portal to be more loose than it was in the past. Back when I was playing, we had to have significant reason for a transfer. I do agree that if coaches and athletic directors, you know, those that make promises to parents and families and kids that we're going to be here and help you matriculate through college and develop into the, you know, young adult that you need to be, if they can make that promise and then, you know, somebody offered them more money to leave and come to another school, the student athlete should be able to do it as well. I, again, just would like to see more moderation when it comes to how it's done. So kids have to be realistic, right? Just because the situation isn't working doesn't mean jumping from one school to the next is going to make it better. It may, in most cases, make it worse. It also has had a serious effect on high school kids because, you know, a guy who has 2 years of experience, it, you know, sitting behind a future first round draft pick can now just bump that kid who was, you know, a 3 or 4 star player coming out of high school, can bump him completely out of the situation because now I've got, as a coach, I've got a kid that I can bring over that's got some playing experience, that has got that discipline and understanding of how the programs and the schedules work. And I don't have to teach a new kid. I don't have to start from scratch. So it makes it difficult with that. In that moderation, I would like to see more of them limiting how many schools can accept transfers. Okay. So instead of limiting the player, the student athlete, limiting the school more so on how they get to do it, similar to what they do in the pros with cap hit. So if, you know, teams want to go out in free agency and bring in players, the bigger the name, the bigger contract that they would have, the bigger the cap hit that they would take. If schools are going to simply recruit through the portal and not give chance to those high school kids, they should also take a quote-unquote cap hit when it comes to how they're able to bring in so many of the transfers. I know that it's not going to be popular because you see a lot of schools, well, my coach went here, I want to go with him and I want to take the whole team. It's not fair to those that are there, and it's not fair to the kids that are trying to get there from high school. So I would like to see something like that implemented.
Cool. And before I let you go, first, I want you to talk a little bit about how do you see your legacy at Tulane and beyond as it stands right now?
The legacy part, I'm, you know, still struggling with understanding how that works. I was talking with Jim earlier about how don't really see myself as part of history yet. Don't completely.
So not necessarily like that. Like, how do you want to, how, when someone says Bernard Robinson, what, right. how do you want to be remembered? Not necessarily, you know, something out of the blue, but just when they right. say Bernard, who, what do you want the thought to be about who Bernard Robinson is?
In regards to my days at Tulane, I definitely want them to be like, that was that hot-headed kid that became something, you know, great, that ended up giving back as much as he could to the institution, to the program, so that others could come behind him and have a similar experience.
Excellent.
And just in general, I would say, just as a good person, as you mentioned beforehand, as a father, as a good husband, as a good leader in the community, a good businessman who, you know, put things together for the benefit of others, but enjoyed life at the same time.
That's great. That's great. And I can give confidence that all of those things have already taken place, but I know you will continue as well, because that's just the kind of person that you are. So we're just excited. I'm excited to know you and be able to call you friend. And I mean, the impact that you have on so many people's lives is just, it's just amazing. And you're just an outstanding leader and person. So I'm excited to have you on today, and we will talk again. We'll have some more tea talk.
Yeah, we will.
I know I've kept you for a long time today. So we're gonna end it today. But yeah, we'll get back together and do a little tea talk coming up. And you'll be my go-to tea talk.
All right. I'll come back anytime you have me.